Well, when we come back, and we will, I want to call upon the power of Nick Pope to tell us something that we absolutely positively do not know, have not heard, but at the same time will not compromise the mystique of the upcoming book, which will be entitled Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. A real teaser. We shall see. This is Coast to Coast AM. John Dean with you for the Saturday Night Ride. And Mr. Pope, is there anything, you know, we've heard about the ones and zeros and the black triangles and some of these other things. Is there something that without compromising, well, as I said earlier, the mystique of the upcoming book, something that you're quite certain we haven't heard of yet that's just a tiny bit, just a little teaser, or do you want me to just, like, back off and just wait for the book?
No, I'm afraid I'm not. I don't want to unpack any spoilers at this stage, I'm afraid.
That's good, though, because what that means is it's going to be quite the mind-blower when it comes out, yes?
I think so, and I know that the publishers are going to try to, I'm sure, get John Burroughs and Jim Penniston on some of the major TV news and chat shows to, you know, hear from the two men who were at the center of this. And yet the two men who, so far, perhaps their story has not been as widely told as it might have been. And I mean no disrespect to Colonel Holt in this, but I think it's inevitably a consequence of his rank, the fact that he was the deputy base commander. It's tended to be that has attracted documentary filmmakers and people writing up this story. And yet, when you actually break it down and look at what happened, it was very much John and Jim who I think have much more of the central role. And it's good. I've seen and noticed over the past few months that certainly TV producers are, I think, beginning to realize that. And Jim and John have done a few shows. But my goodness, I think when the book comes out, they'll get a heck of a lot more.
You know, I've got a couple of questions for you, Nick. President Harry S. Truman, he was just as sober as a judge, sitting there talking about how, well, these things happen every once in a while. I'm paraphrasing, but he said the words flying saucer. But these things happen all the time. And then there was Gordon Cooper, who there's a video on YouTube. You can see the man sitting there. This is a real astronaut. And he's saying, this little saucer came down. A film crew that was already filming ran over to it and continued to film. The little thing just levitated off the ground, tilted up a little bit, retracted its gear, and took off. And then Buzz Aldrin was talking about, wait till people find out that there's a monolith on this little thing, on this little rock, that little potato-shaped rock that orbits Mars something every 7 hours. So wait till they find out about this. And everybody just yawned. And I'm just wondering. Is it going to take an expose over the mainstream television medium to bring the proper attention to bear on this?
Well, I don't know. I think you've hit the nail on the head with one of the problems of all this, and it's information overload. There's so much good information out there. So many good cases. So many credible witnesses. So many major figures, whether they're politicians, military people, astronauts, who are prepared to step up to the plate, that it almost becomes, you know, old news. And people say, oh, yeah, here's another astronaut saying all this is real. Here's another, you know, senior retired general saying he believes this is true. Here's a former deputy prime minister saying it's all the rumors are true, and it all happened exactly how they said it happened, and you know, it almost ceases to be news. And some people would say that information overload is almost a deliberate tactic to flood the media with this, so that the story, it almost can be hidden in plain sight. You know, one of the phrases that I use a lot these days is that the best place to hide a book is in a library. And the information is out there, and a lot of it is out there. But take the Ministry of Defence files again, go back to where we started. There are 54,000 pages of material out there. And a lot of people say, oh, I've had a flick through, and I've noticed there's an awful lot of reports of fire lanterns. Well, yes, but you have to spend rather more time, and reading government documents is something of an art in itself, and sometimes it's as important to spot what isn't there as to spot what is.
Yes. Well, when you were on the desk, were the calls that you got mostly sightings of aircraft? Was there any mention of animal mutilations or any actual abductions?
Yes, we got a few reports. We got a few abduction reports. We heard some rumors and did see some material about animal mutilations, mostly sheep in the UK. I think some cattle, possibly some horses as well. It was very difficult. Our terms of reference really limited us to look at UFOs. We could only really look at these things because of the perceived link. But certainly I would have liked to have done a lot more on animal mutilations. There was a very complicated legal situation as well, having to do with insurance companies not paying out, obviously, for anything weird. Pardon me?
I never thought of that.
Yeah, it was a big problem. So farmers and the vets would effectively get together and note all these strange deaths down as just attacks from dogs, because that was the only thing the insurance companies would pay out on.
So no dogs with scalpels?
No dogs with scalpels or lasers. But I was convinced that there was more information out there, but it was very difficult to crack open, as I say, because people's livelihoods were at stake. And people were saying, look, I can't say anything other than dog attack, because if I claim that there was a UFO sighted over the area and something strange happens, the insurance company won't pay out, and the farming community in the UK has always been struggled, and it's a difficult situation for them all.
Mm-hmm. That's the old probably balloon syndrome.
Yes, indeed.
Well, do we have any idea? Has anyone recorded a number of how many people have seen a UFO? If there were 12,000 sightings, I assume they weren't all spotted by the same person, so there are probably several thousand people there. But I wonder if there's any way to know how many people, in the countries that we have some communication with, Canada, South America. Not, I don't mean like the great tundra or anything, but I wonder how many people have actually witnessed this. I wonder if there's a sufficient number of them to go, look, we want some disclosure and we want it now.
It's a very good question, and I've often pondered that, but it's difficult because, of course, there are a number of countries where the regime is such that it's not an open democratic society. There isn't a free press. There isn't free internet access. In other countries, poverty is the issue, and it's not that they're not free, but they just don't have access necessarily to computers to go reporting.
Yeah, no help desk.
Yeah, because they're too busy out earning a living.
Right.
The other issue, the big issue in all countries, is of course underreporting. And for every person, if you've got 12,000 UFO reports in the MOD's files, the number of people who's probably saw something and haven't reported it is I'm betting at least 10 times that, maybe 100 times that. So globally, even if you take 1947 as your start point and forget all the older sightings that we've alluded to when we talk, for example, about medieval and Renaissance paintings, and of course, people have always seen strange things in the sky, but even if you take 47 as your start point and roll forward from there, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't have a million sightings.
Mm-hmm. I keep one little thing that nags is the radiation level around the craft at Bellwaters.
Yes, and that, of course, is a huge concern for John Burroughs and Jim Peniston. I mentioned, you know, their health issues. I can't go into the details, of course, because of confidentiality. But sure. I did mention, and it is in the public domain, that the congressional representatives at the Citizen Hearing for Disclosure have now written to the President of the United States and to the Secretary of the Department for Veterans Affairs to try and get those medical records out of the system somehow, so that John and Jim, if they have been irradiated by this craft, can get a proper diagnosis, because, you know, they can't get the proper treatment without the proper diagnosis, and they can't get the diagnosis without access to their medical records.
Yeah, now, without being crass, what demographic are these men in now?
Oh, 50s, you know.
Ah. Yeah, well, they need to know, don't they? Now's the time. That's the age where you need to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly with the healthcare industry going the way it is, I understand that. I just saw a report recently. I digress here just for a moment, but I understand that somewhere around your early to mid 70s, if you manage to pick up a cancer, you're pretty much on your own. So it would be if they've been irradiated, they need some help with that. You know, we keep going back to these congressional representatives here and there. Have you observed? In the United States, it seemed that a strong case could be made for access to UFO information being contingent upon your political affiliation. Reagan, yes. Carter, no. Clinton, no. Bush, yes. It seems that it went around for several years that off and on. That if a Republican was much more likely to have access to UFO data than a Democrat.
I've heard that. My own view is that if there is highly classified information about UFOs that the American government hasn't released, I know a lot of people love this little soundbite about, you know, X levels of classification above top secret, and even the president wouldn't know, and people talk about plausible deniability. With my own, albeit British, experience of this, but 21 years in government, I think every president would have to know if this was true. Because only the commander-in-chief, for example, can authorize military action, and only the commander-in-chief can take a number of decisions which, in extremis, might have to be taken, depending on what unfolds with the UFO situation. So, if there is this information, it would be inconceivable to me that the president wouldn't know, because only the president could take certain decisions. So, you know, they would have to be pre-briefed.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Do you find that ufology in the UK is somewhat similar to what's being done in the US? I'm thinking it might be more advanced because it's a smaller area and thousands of sightings, so it might be a more concentrated effort over there.
Well, I think there are some good people in the UFO community, both in America and in the US, and there are some pretty crazy people as well. So. Right. I live in America now, as I say, and I'm still in touch, obviously, with people in the UK. But there are some very good researchers in Britain. Timothy Good is someone who springs to mind. John Spencer, Lynn Pecknett, a number of other people involved in this. And, you know, people like Timothy Good, Philip Mantle, Malcolm Robinson, Georgina Bruni, who sadly died a few years ago, but people like that made Freedom of Information Acts, which really were the key, though none of them were responsible individually, of course, but the key to, of course, forcing the government finally to open the files in the UK. So, and people like Timothy Good, I think, continue to make Freedom of Information Act requests, even though the UFO project has now been closed down and the files are at the National Archives. But yeah, so there are some tremendously good and prolific researchers, and I'm sure many of those individuals have been on Coast to Coast.
You know, just in looking at your areas of interest, the unexplained, conspiracy theory, space science fiction, fringe science, and of course, defense and intelligence. Do you think that a fairly good case could be made for these ETs? I mean, who knows what's piloting them or from what distance? But they seem to be fairly patient with us, because anything that can accelerate and fly away like that certainly could. Just as you were talking about Mr. Torres, he's going... I felt like a lamb being led to the slaughter here. He really didn't want to open fire on that craft. And it just said, well, don't worry about it, kid. You're not going to have to, because we're going to go ahead and split. And they did. And I'm just wondering, what do you make of their seeming patience with us?
Well, I think there are a number of possibilities here. Firstly is that we might be dealing with anthropologists, people who are maybe observing but not interacting, because of course the interaction, you know, effectively brings contamination. Now, if you want to sort of trivialize that and call it the Star Trek prime directive, fair enough, but I think the principle holds, and there is a certain logic about that. So that's one possible explanation. Another possibility is, of course, we are dealing with something for which patience is not the issue, and time is not the issue that it would be for us. And I'm talking, of course, about artificial intelligence, machine intelligence. And I attended two discussion meetings put on by the Royal Society in 2010, and in relation to the question about the search for extraterrestrial life, the phrase immortal thinking machine cropped up several times, and you might think that was the sort of thing you'd hear at a sci-fi convention, and there it is being discussed at the Royal Society. So a couple of options there, or potential options.
Yeah. Well, so in recent, as far as recent memory is concerned, not the Battle of Los Angeles or any of that, but no one has actually fired on one of these craft that we know of. They were ordered to, but didn't do it.
Let me think. Parviz Jafari, in 1976 over Iran, attempted to fire an air-to-air missile at a UFO because he believed he was under attack. And Oscar Santa Maria Huertas did open fire on one in 1980. Perhaps we can discuss that after the break.
Okay. All right. Let's do that then. Let's just... let's take our break and come back with Nick Pope. Fascinating discussion underway tonight, don't you think? Happy to be with you on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks, sir. Won't be seeing you anymore if one of those things was to land and some, you know, sort of benign-looking creature said, come on board, pal, let me show you something. I'm thinking I might say, okay, how long will we be gone? Oh, don't worry about it. You won't be gone for any time at all. We'll simply use the warp feature on this special little craft, and we'll get you right back at about 2 seconds after you leave. How about that? I'm all in, I'm telling you. All right, final segment with Nick Pope in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So, back to our discussion about the extraordinarily brave move of arming your missiles and pointing them at a UFO.
Yes, indeed. Probably not to be recommended. But,
no.
You know, I mentioned that Parviz Jafari had attempted to fire an air-to-air missile. In fact, he was unable to do so. He said it was as if his weapons control panel had been somehow taken offline. I mean, everything else worked, but his weapon system was inoperative.
I mean, are these guys something or are they something? And he was over Iran, yeah?
That's right. Back in the day, of course, where Iran was ruled by the Shah and was actually an ally of America. So there was that case. There was the Milton Torres case that I mentioned from 1957 when he was ordered to shoot down the UFO. And then just before the break, I mentioned, in fact, he was a Peruvian Air Force pilot, Oscar Santa Maria Huertas. And he was ordered to open fire on a UFO that had strayed into restricted military airspace. And he actually did with his machine cannon. And he said he was confident that he hit this thing, whatever it was, but he said that it was as if the rounds were, the word he used was absorbed by this craft. He said he didn't miss, they didn't ricochet off, they were just absorbed, and it had no discernible effect on the UFO at all.
You know, I'm thinking that that might tie in with that craft that was directly over the base and then went to the horizon line without making a ground wave, a shock wave, nor a boom, a sonic boom.
Yes, I think we can draw parallels between a lot of these cases. And again, I didn't have time to mention, but in relation to the wave of sightings I mentioned from 1993, one of the interesting little postscripts about that whole story was that it happened 3 years to the very night after that occasion in 1990, where the Belgians actually launched two F-16 fighters to intercept a huge triangular-shaped UFO that had been picked up on the Belgian national radar and indeed on the NATO integrated radar system.
Let me ask you something about these black triangles. You know, the British just unveiled, it must have been, I'm thinking, 3 or 4 months ago, this wonderful, it's a lighter-than-air craft that's designed to be up there for a long time. It's a big shark-looking thing. It's very, very stylish, very cool. It looks like a big manta ray. In fact, I think that might be the name of it. Not the ray, but I want to say they called it the manta. I might be wrong.
Well, there's an awful lot of prototype spy planes, drones. People are talking about airships coming back and being something that the aviation industry will look at again with fresh eyes. So there's a lot of unconventional craft out there.
I keep hearing about nuclear engines and electromagnetines, I think they are. Do you hear any of that stuff? Just, I don't mean in official circles, I mean just pub chat, so to speak.
No, I can't say that I do.
Okay.
No, that doesn't resonate with me.
I hope you don't mind my just firing off these questions.
Not at all.
Well, so if we think GCHQ and the NSA, they've been listening to people for years, and people are like, oh, no, they don't. It's like, well, yes, actually, they do. NSA has been listening for a long time, and FBI, too, I'm sure. And so the Americans, a couple of weeks ago, we began our incandescence over the whole thing, which is just generally assumed. The moment that it gets onto the television, though, it automatically has some instant credibility, and so they're just really stating what many of us have thought for a long time. So I'm leading up to this question, which is, if there existed actual proof, I mean, you would think that the aircraft would be, or whatever they are, the craft would be sufficient proof considering the number of people who have seen them. But if there were proof, do you believe that it would be released and identified as such? I mean, do you think they would do it, or do you think that it's undeniable, but we're still denying it?
Well, I think, I mentioned earlier technology acquisition and the fact that I thought that that lay at the heart of UFO secrecy. And perhaps I can answer the question you've just asked by going back to that point and just adding an additional rider to it. I think, imagine a situation where Roswell is real, and let's not have the debate, let's just assume for the purposes of the conversation it's real. This presents the United States as the country in which this incident has happened with an unprecedented opportunity in terms of technology acquisition. Now, bear in mind the political context as well, that took place against the beginnings of the Cold War. In that situation, ask yourself, in a competition effectively between the United States and the Soviet Union, but with other countries as well, such as China, beginning to perhaps be perceived as a potential threat, are you going to take this fantastic windfall that you've just had in terms of technology and share it with everyone, tell the world? Or are you going to squirrel it away somewhere, work on it in secret, and see if you can develop this exclusively for your own use?
Oh, I'm thinking the latter.
Absolutely. Because, and again, this is one of my sound bites that I have used before, but I think it's a point worth repeating. The country, or maybe even corporation on Earth that first acquires this technology, if indeed that technology is there to be acquired, is going to be the dominant force, dominant power on this planet, militarily, politically, economically, for the foreseeable future. That being the case, I would suggest there are very high stakes and more than sufficient justification for anyone, if they could keep this secret, possibly, you know, if it was possible to do so, they would. I certainly would. I mean, if I was still working in government.
Yeah.
That would be my mindset.
Wouldn't it just follow that as one domino falls into the other, that it would be like, hey, forget about that vaporizer from the Terragons. We'll get a hold of the Zorgons, and we'll use that thing they've got. That puts that other thing in the shade. Forget about it. Let's talk with them. And it becomes some huge arms race. And here we are on this little planet going, no, we need even bigger weapons. Idiots. You know, it's like, where does this stop? I used to enjoy watching boxing every once in a while, and then it occurred to me, what are you watching? You know, you're watching two grown men just beat each other into pulps. And you just look at all this violence around the world and you think, we're not ready. We're not ready for anything. We're still in the terrible twos as a civilization, as a global civilization. You agree with this?
I don't know. It depends what else is out there. And in a sense, that's unknowable. I think sometimes do ourselves down a bit, and you know, yes, it's easy to focus on some of the negative things, but some of what we do is altruistic, and it may be that some of our achievements here are very positive. So I don't know. Maybe our and that raises another interesting question. I mean, if we are being visited by another civilization, self-evidently their technology is more advanced than ours, we're not going to have anything to teach them about science and technology, are we? I mean, you know, so back to the question, why would they come? They would come as explorers and anthropologists, and if they're interested in anything, as I say, it won't be our engineering, our physics, it will be our art, our literature, our architecture. And that's why one of the most amusing but profound documents in the entire MOD UFO files is an assessment done by the intelligence staff. And I haven't got it in front of me, but quoting almost from memory, it's an assessment of the UFO phenomenon. It says, in the absence of any apparent hostile intent, possible explanations include 1, military reconnaissance, 2, scientific investigation, 3, tourism. Now, tourism always gets a big laugh when I quote that document, But in fact, I think it's an interesting and you know, well-made point.
I think it is too. I mean, you got a little chuckle out of me. It was subdued, but it's like that's the bright spot in all of this, though. It really is. I mean, wouldn't that be great? A lot of people right now are prepared to. You bet. I'll go on a one-way trip to Mars as long as the digs are satisfactory and it's an interesting trip and we survive for a while. I'm in. What does that say about anybody that they're like willing to give up dear old planet Earth and let's see what's next?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I've got one for you, Nick, and it is this. If a benign creature standing outside a craft much like the one that landed at Bentwaters invited you to come on board, would you do it?
Yes.
Excellent. That was a quick answer.
Well, I don't think that one has a government job to research and investigate this and then doesn't want to get the answer after all of that. So, yes.
Oh, that's excellent. All right. Well, we've got a few minutes here, so let's catch up on a couple of things that I don't think we touched on, and that's the state of SETI and astrobiology. You have any comments you'd like to leave us with? And for that matter, you can just have the floor for the next 7 minutes and just we'll touch on SETI, astrobiology, and any other message you'd like to broadcast to the world.
Well, I think that sometimes the UFO community and the SETI community don't get on, to say the least. But I think that's unfortunate because it seems to me that we're dealing with two groups of people who are essentially looking for the same thing, but in different places and with a different methodology and with a different and underlying belief system about what the nature of what they're looking for is. But I think there is, ironically, far more that binds them together than sets them apart. And one of the things, it's probably not really realistic, but I doesn't mean it's not something we should aspire to, but I would like to see some bridges built between the UFO community and the SETI community. And I think the interesting thing about the SETI community is that they are now building up for 2024 and the Square Kilometer Array radio telescope, which there is going to be a huge bun fight over telescope time, of course, but if SETI scientists get any time or sufficient time on the Square Kilometer Array, it's going to be a remarkable machine, and it might just be the mechanism by which we find out that we're not alone. And you know, in a sense, if the SETI community beats the UFO community to the finish line, in a sense, it doesn't matter. It certainly doesn't matter to me. I don't care who discovers alien life, proof of other civilization. I don't care whether it's a ufologist or a SETI scientist or who it is. I'm just keen to see it happen.
Well, why not? Just because you don't wear a lab coat and do your thing in an expensive environment sanctioned by a higher academia. The Wright brothers were a couple of motorcycle mechanics in a garage. And they had lots of grease on their hands, and they managed to get an airplane into the air. You know, you had said that a short time ago, everyone had a little piece of the puzzle, but no one had put it all together. But now with the declassification release of the British government's, effectively, the X-Files, we can see the entire picture. Do you still feel that way? And if so, what is the entire picture?
No, I'm not sure that the entire picture has yet been painted. As I say, too many documents have been partially blacked out or completely withheld. And again, I didn't have time to get into this. But in something that really has conspiracy theorists up in arms, many of the best files, documents, photos have gone missing or have been inadvertently destroyed. Some of the Rendlesham Forest files, some Defence Intelligence staff Rendlesham Forest files, for example, have been supposedly inadvertently destroyed. Some of the old gun camera footage that fighter jets took of UFOs that they were intercepting back in the 50s and the 60s, that's all gone, lost. Even the best ever photo that we were sent, which was on my office wall for years, that's been lost.
Lost?
Yes.
Is that lost with quotes around it, or do we think it's really lost?
I don't want to go into that level any accusation. The Ministry of Defense states that this material Understood. Has been lost.
Gotcha.
But, clearly it's an unfortunate situation. A ship's log that might have revealed a very interesting UFO sighting was apparently blown overboard by a freak gust of wind. You can see that we almost descend to levels of farce here.
Mm-hmm. Well, where next for ufology, Nick?
Well, very interesting question. I don't know. I think the thing that we always forget is that the subject is events-led, and it may be one area to watch is, of course, something like WikiLeaks. I don't want to get into a situation where I'm condoning the leaking of classified information for reasons I discussed earlier,
right.
But it's interesting to speculate that we now have the structure, as it were, that might be the way in which any highly classified UFO documents that are out there do come into the public light. So let's wait and see.
It's been absolutely excellent to have you on the program tonight, Nick Pope, and I appreciate your time and everything that you were able to tell us tonight. I look forward to meeting you in person one day.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
All right, then. Have a happy Sunday. And remember, if humankind, if you don't like the man part, if we were actually able, as a global civilization, to go completely global, well, it'd all be good, wouldn't it? But if we can't, then the same mistakes will be made, and old Solomon will be validated once again. There's absolutely nothing new under the sun. It'll seem like an eternity between Saturday night and next Saturday night, but I look forward to being with you again at that time, until then and beyond. Have a happy 4th of July. Remember why we have it. Good night, and be well.